From NPR News in Washington, this is special live coverage of President Barack Obama's address to a joint session of Congress. I'm Melissa Block. From the U.S. Capitol in a few moments, the president will speak for the first time to a packed House chamber. Lawmakers and dignitaries, Supreme Court justices are gathered, and of course he is speaking as well to the American people. President Obama's speech tonight will focus largely on the ongoing economic crisis, which has dominated his first month in office. The president will also talk about his other priorities in office, including health care, education, energy, and deficit reduction. And with us now, as we lead up to the speech, is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, we're hearing the sound in the House chamber as the president prepares to make his entrance. He is not there yet. We see Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi standing next to Vice President Joe Biden.
Yes, this is the president's first address to a joint session of Congress. It's not an official State of the Union address. That would start next year. But the president has a big job tonight. He has to not only lay out his policies and goals for the rest of the year on energy and health care and education, he also has to sell what he just signed into law. The stimulus is still pretty controversial. The bank bailout is still a work in progress. And I guess if there's any model for this speech tonight, it's that famous fireside chat that FDR gave where people had taken the money out of the banks and were hiding it in their mattresses, and he went on the radio, and the next thing you know, the next day, at least the story has it, they lined up around the block to put their money back in the banks. And I think he wants to be very realistic with the American people, which he has been since he was elected, but also optimistic and address the real panic and fear that's in the psychology of the country right now.
And as I learned today from our own Ken Rudin on his blog, this could be, if he chose, could be called a State of the Union address. There's no rule against it, but he's called it an address to a joint session of Congress. And both members of both houses are in the House chamber now. It's always a key moment if you get an aisle-side seat, Mar. You can reach and shake the president's hand as he makes his way
into the chamber. Yes, and some people come very early to stake out that aisle-side seat, and you can probably see a couple red jackets in the crowd. That's another prerogative of female members of Congress. If they can wear a red jacket, maybe they'll attract a television camera.
Try to stand out.
Madam Speaker. Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court.
And as the Justices and the Chief Justice make their way into the chamber, we hear the applause in the chamber as they make their way in. There were members of the diplomatic corps as well. There's always one member of the cabinet, Mara, who is not in the room.
That's right. This year it's Eric Holder, the Attorney General, and he's going to be in an undisclosed location. And the reason why they always choose someone to stay out is in case some horrible disaster should happen in the House chamber and they need somebody to be left. It's kind of a gruesome thought, but it is an important ritual in the State of the Union.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg now getting a lot of handshakes as she makes her way down the aisle. Of course, she's recovering from surgery for pancreatic cancer. Mara, obviously a lot of attention given to the tone of this speech and a lot of attention in the White House, I'm sure, exactly how hopeful a message this is, how dire a message the president should be painting of the economy and where things are. Well, the boundary between hope and realism.
Yes, I think a lot of attention's been paid to it. It's also kind of taken up a lot of cable chatter. And
yes.
President,
and
President Clinton, you know, made a comment that made it sound like he was criticizing Obama for being too downbeat. But look, I think the tone is important, but even more important is how he makes this argument. I mean, he is getting a whole hour of uninterrupted time to explain to the American people what his stimulus is going to do, and most importantly, why the economic recovery plans that he has are not just for Wall Street and for bankers and for the auto companies, but why they're going to help ordinary Americans. Because as popular as the president is, he has job approval ratings in the mid-60s, there is this undercurrent of populist anger that he would rather harness for himself than be the victim of. And I think it's very important that the president make that argument and really convince people that the things he's doing are not to bail out the people who got us into this mess, mm-hmm. but in fact to right the economy and put it on a stronger and more responsible track than it was before.
And the First Lady, Michelle Obama, is entering the chamber. We're preparing also for the entry of the president's cabinet. Worth noting, Mara, there are a few key members of that cabinet, a few key posts that have not been filled. There's been some trouble there.
Yes, there are a few key posts that have not filled. There was some thought that he would try to fill the HHS position that Tom Daschle removed his name from nomination. And also the Commerce Department. We know that Gary Locke, who is the former governor of Washington State, will be the Commerce Secretary. He will be announced tomorrow. They haven't settled yet on a Health and Human Services Secretary, although Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, is the top prospect there.
And Michelle Obama in her seat in the gallery, surrounded by what's now become a commonplace of citizens
Speaker,
from around the country.
The President's Cabinet.
And here is the President's Cabinet as they make their way into the chamber. It's an interesting array of folks who are going to be there tonight, Mara, and there are many of them sitting alongside the First Lady up looking out over this chamber tonight, and the President will be talking about them, some of them, in his speech.
Yeah, he'll be mentioning them in his speech. They're ordinary Americans from all walks of life. I'm sure you have the list right in front of them, One of them is a banker who sold his bank and decided to take the proceeds and give them to his employees instead of pocketing them. So an example of the kind of thing that that Obama wants to
corporate responsibility to
recreate.
And a number of students, including from Washington, D.C., but also from one young girl from South Carolina. We're seeing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, Defense Secretary Robert Gates all making their way through. Of course, Hillary Clinton, a former member of this body and once a member of the Senate, always a member of the Senate, I suppose. And next to come will be President Obama.
See the Interior Secretary and the Agriculture Secretary coming down there. And the Housing and Transportation close behind.
All of these key components of what the President will be talking about tonight. I mean, this is a long and sort of laborious process as they make their way through, and it happens this way every year. It will be the House Sergeant at Arms announcing the President when it's time. Let's bring briefly E.J. Dionne and Matt Continetti into the conversation. E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard. And briefly, in the time that we have, Matt, you first, your expectations for this speech tonight.
Well, in a way, it's a capstone. He's capping off a successful month. I mean, it took Obama 3 weeks to expand the government by about 15%, so good job, well done for him. And, of course, as Mara noted, he has high approval ratings, about the average for the last six presidents. It's a capstone, but I think he's also going to expand on the language of responsibility and sacrifice that he talked about in his inaugural address, except now's the time he's going to start using the prose of that argument that a lot of people thought was missing from the poetry of the inaugural address.
E.J. Dionne?
Obviously he wants to build confidence again in the future by showing the government knows what it's doing. He wants to explain why the banks are in trouble, and this is where, as Mara suggested, he really is drawing on FDR. As speechwriter Jon Favreau had been reading FDR's fireside chats, where he explained in homely, clear language what was happening in the economic system. And then he's going to argue that this crisis is not an excuse for walking away from his promises, but he's going to talk about moving aggressively on energy independence and clean energy, on education, and on health care. I think that one big piece of news we're going to hear tonight, it's not news because it's been leaked so much, is that he wants to get health care reform done this year. A lot of people thought he might put it off. He's not putting it off.
It's interesting if you think about those fireside chats. Of course, they were over the intimate medium of radio. This is obviously not an intimate medium at all. The address to a joint session of Congress, it's sort of an interesting tension between the message and the format of this speech, don't you think?
Well, right. Of course, if you ask Vice President Biden, who famously said that FDR got on TV during the Great Depression, and thought that wasn't available. But Obama is a master of whatever the new medium is. And the new medium these days, of course, is still TV, but also the Internet, and with his weekly YouTube addresses and stuff. Like Roosevelt, he is a master of these mediums of communication.
And while we all know there's something very special about radio, there is an awful lot of intimacy in the sense that a lot of families are going to be sitting around living rooms and maybe even talking about what he says. So he is, in some deep sense, going to try to recapture that feeling.
Yeah. And again, we're waiting for the arrival of President Barack Obama for this address to a joint session of Congress. It'll be announced by Wilson Livingood, the House Sergeant at Arms. Mara, after tonight's speech, is the President doing another, what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, another road trip to try to sort of sell his policies out in the country?
You know, he is going somewhere on Friday, and I don't think that they've announced it yet, but, you know, they've said that he's going to travel just about once a week. And I think they always plan to send him out, but they started sending him out a little earlier than they thought they would have to when the stimulus bill wasn't so much in trouble, but he was trying to sell it, and it was taking a lot of incoming fire in Washington. So they put him on the road, and they believe that the approval for the stimulus package went up when people saw him interacting with ordinary Americans outside of Washington.
In a sort of town meeting format.
Yeah, in a town meeting format. So they're obviously going to continue doing that. They think that right now there is no danger of this very popular president being overexposed. I mean, they've got him out there in many, many different settings. He's been giving interviews, although this isn't completely their doing. I mean, you walk to any newsstand in the country, and it's a sea of magazine covers, and all of them have Obama's face on them. So they feel he certainly is their best, sales tool for whatever it is he's selling.
And especially because at one point it was considered that the Democrats had let the message get away from them, that the Republicans had taken control. We're waiting now, the entrance of the president into the House chamber.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
President Obama is now making his way into the House chamber, shaking hands as he makes his way slowly down the aisle toward the rostrum to deliver his address. Behind him is the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, other members of the congressional leadership, I saw Steny Hoyer from the House, John Boehner, the Republican Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, Senator from Kentucky, whom we hope to speak with later on the broadcast. And I want to turn now also to another gentleman here in our studio, NPR economics correspondent John Idstey. Obviously, John, you've been tracking the stimulus package, the bank bailout. This is a plan that has many, many arms and legs growing all the time. And what other chunks of this still need to fall into place? What else are we waiting for?
Well, I think we still need a detail on the bank bailout plan. We've had some details on it in the last couple of days about the government maybe converting some of its preferred shares in banks into common stock and taking greater control of some of the banks. But we saw the financial markets respond very positively today when we heard Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke say these stress tests that they're doing on the banks, these moves that they're making are not aimed at nationalizing banks. And the stock markets responded up about 4% today.
Yeah, it's been quite striking to see the markets as they either tumble or rise based on just about any word coming out of either this White House, the Fed chairman, or the Treasury secretary's mouth.
It's a precarious position to be in, to be at the mercy of the markets.
E.G. Dionne and Matt Connelly, as you watch Barack Obama make his way through the chamber, does it strike you that expectations for what the speech could do are unnecessarily high tonight, or do we need to tamp down expectations, or do you think this is realistic what we're talking about here?
I think they're necessarily high. I was out in Akron, Ohio, a few days ago, sort of the heartland of industrial America, and there is enormous amount of fear in the country. People don't know where this is going. They don't know how long it's going to last. In Akron, one of the tire companies announced 5,000 layoffs. They weren't clear how many of them were going to be in Akron. And so it's a short presidency, so it's easy to say. In a lot of ways, this is more important than his inaugural address. And he's got to resell some of the programs he's already enacted.
The expectations for Obama were already so high, it's hard to imagine how they would get higher if he's actually going to start levitating or something like that. I'm struck, of course, as we hear the reaction to him, the crowd is going wild. Everyone wants a piece of Obama. It's almost like a rock concert. And there's something of an Obama effect. When we look at the polls, we see not only is Obama popular, but he's also lifting the congressional Democrats' approval ratings. They're at a record high since they took over Congress 2 years ago. So there's something to be grateful for there. In terms of the speech, the famous phrase is political economy. These days the focus is more on political than it is on economy, and that's why the markets hang on every single word uttered by this administration.
President Obama greeting his cabinet, greeting the members of the Supreme Court, the justices and the Chief Justice. And we have not mentioned tonight, of course, we'll be bringing you the president's address in its entirety. We'll also be bringing you the Republican response, and the man chosen to deliver that response is a young Republican governor, Bobby Jindal, of Louisiana. Interesting choice, Matt Continetti, and certainly an interesting counterpoint to Barack Obama, whom we'll see today.
Very interesting. Someone who has been talked about as the Republican Obama, a Rhodes Scholar, extremely intelligent, young governor, has been in Congress already, the go-to guy for health care issues when he was in Congress and inside the Bush administration. I think he'll talk a lot about health care in his response to Obama.
E.J. Dionne, President Obama is very close. He is making his way up onto the dais to deliver his address. He is about to shake the hands of his Vice President Joseph Biden and the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and he is now taking his place at the podium.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please. Madam Speaker,
Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Thank you.
A little bit of crosstalk there as Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi introduces the President. And he seems to want to get his speech going right away. Standing ovation for President Obama as he prepares to deliver
Thank
his
you.
Remarks to Congress.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Please. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, the First Lady of the United States,
and sustained applause for First Lady Michelle Obama.
I have come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women in this great chamber, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. I know that for many Americans watching right now, the state of our economy is a concern that rises above all others, and rightly so. If you haven't been personally affected by this recession, you probably know someone who has, a friend, a neighbor, a member of your family. You don't need to hear another list of statistics to know that our economy is in crisis because you live it every day. It's the worry you wake up with and the source of sleepless nights. It's the job you thought you'd retire from but now have lost, the business you built your dreams upon that's now hanging by a thread, the college acceptance letter your child had to put back in the envelope. The impact of this recession is real, and it is everywhere. But while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
And members of both parties rising from their seats with that line from President Obama, the first applause line of the speech.
The weight of this crisis will not determine the destiny of this nation. The answers to our problems don't lie beyond our reach. They exist in our laboratories, in our universities, in our fields, in our factories, in the imaginations of our entrepreneurs, and the pride of the hardest working people on earth. Those qualities that have made America the greatest force of progress and prosperity in human history, we still possess in ample measure. What is required now is for this country to pull together, confront boldly the challenges we face, and take responsibility for our future once more. Now, if we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that for too long we have not always met these responsibilities, as a government or as a people. I say this not to lay blame or to look backwards, but because it is only by understanding how we arrived at this moment that we'll be able to lift ourselves out of this predicament. The fact is, our economy did not fall into decline overnight, nor did all of our problems begin when the housing market collapsed or the stock market sank. We have known for decades that our survival depends on finding new sources of energy. Yet we import more oil today than ever before. The cost of health care eats up more and more of our savings each year. Yet we keep delaying reform. Our children will compete for jobs in a global economy that too many of our schools do not prepare them for. And though all of these challenges went unsolved, we still managed to spend more money and pile up more debt, both as individuals and through our government, than ever before. In other words, we have lived through an era where too often short-term gains were prized over long-term prosperity, where we failed to look beyond the next payment, the next quarter, or the next election. The surplus became an excuse to transfer wealth to the wealthy instead of an opportunity to invest in our future. Regulations were gutted for the sake of a quick profit at the expense of a healthy market. People bought homes they knew they couldn't afford from banks and lenders who pushed those bad loans anyway. And all the while, critical debates and difficult decisions were put off for some other time on some other day. Well, that day of reckoning has arrived, and the time to take charge of our future is here. Now is the time to act boldly and wisely. To not only revive this economy, but to build a new foundation for lasting prosperity. Now's the time to jumpstart job creation, restart lending, and invest in areas like energy, healthcare, and education that will grow our economy even as we make hard choices to bring our deficit down. That is what my economic agenda is designed to do, and that is what I'd like to talk to you about tonight. It's an agenda that begins with jobs. As soon as I took office, I asked this Congress to send me a recovery plan by President's Day that would put people back to work and put money in their pockets. Not because I believe in bigger government. I don't. Not because I'm not mindful of the massive debt we've inherited. I am. I called for action because the failure to do so would have cost more jobs and caused more hardship. In fact, a failure to act would have worsened our long-term deficit by assuring weak economic growth for years. And that's why I pushed for quick action. And tonight I am grateful that this Congress delivered and pleased to say that the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act is now law. Over the next 2 years, this plan will save or create 3.5 million jobs. More than 90% of these jobs will be in the private sector, jobs rebuilding our roads and bridges, constructing wind turbines and solar panels, laying broadband, and expanding mass transit. Because of this plan, there are teachers who can now keep their jobs and educate our kids. Healthcare professionals can continue caring for our sick. There are 57 police officers who are still on the streets of Minneapolis tonight because this plan prevented the layoffs their department was about to make. Because of this plan, 95% of working households in America will receive a tax cut. A tax cut that you will see in your paychecks beginning on April 1st. Because of this plan, families who are struggling to pay tuition costs will receive a $2,500 tax credit for all 4 years of college. And Americans who have lost their jobs in this recession will be able to receive extended unemployment benefits and continued health care coverage to help them weather this storm. Now, I know there are some in this chamber and watching at home who are skeptical of whether this plan will work. And I understand that skepticism. Here in Washington, we've all seen how quickly good intentions can turn into broken promises and wasteful spending. And with a plan of this scale comes enormous responsibility to get it right. And that's why I've asked Vice President Biden to lead a tough, unprecedented oversight effort, because nobody messes with Joe. Am I right? You don't mess with him.
The first laugh line of the president's address to Congress, Joe Biden with a long history in the Congress.
I have told each of my cabinet, as well as mayors and governors across the country, that they will be held accountable by me and the American people for every dollar they spend. I've appointed a proven and aggressive inspector general to ferret out any and all cases of waste and fraud. And we have created a new website called recovery.gov so that every American can find out how and where their money is being spent. So the recovery plan we passed is the first step in getting our economy back on track. But it is just the first step. Because even if we manage this plan flawlessly, there will be no real recovery unless we clean up the credit crisis that has severely weakened our financial system. I want to speak plainly and candidly about this issue tonight because every American should know that it directly affects you and your family's well-being. You should also know that the money you've deposited in banks across the country is safe, your insurance is secure. You can rely on the continued operation of our financial system. That's not the source of concern. The concern is that if we do not restart lending in this country, our recovery will be choked off before it even begins. You see, the flow of credit is the lifeblood of our economy. The ability to get a loan is how you finance the purchase of everything from a home to a car to a college education, how stores stock their shelves, farms buy equipment, and businesses make payroll. But credit has stopped flowing the way it should. Too many bad loans from the housing crisis have made their way onto the books of too many banks. And with so much debt and so little confidence, these banks are now fearful of lending out any more money to households, to businesses, or even to each other. And when there's no lending, families can't afford to buy homes or cars. So businesses are forced to make layoffs. Our economy suffers even more, and credit dries up even further. That is why this administration is moving swiftly and aggressively to break this destructive cycle, to restore confidence and restart lending. And we will do so in several ways. First, we are creating a new lending fund that represents the largest effort ever to help provide auto loans, college loans, and small business loans to the consumers and entrepreneurs who keep this economy running. Second, we have launched a housing plan that will help responsible families facing the threat of foreclosure lower their monthly payments and refinance their mortgages. It's a plan that won't help speculators or that neighbor down the street who bought a house he could never hope to afford, but it will help millions of Americans who are struggling with declining home values, Americans who will now be able to take advantage of the lower interest rates that this plan has already helped to bring about. In fact, the average family who refinances today can save nearly $2,000 per year on their mortgage. Third, we will act with the full force of the federal government to ensure that the major banks that Americans depend on have enough confidence and enough money to lend even in more difficult times. And when we learn that a major bank has serious problems, we will hold accountable those responsible, force the necessary adjustments, provide the support to clean up their balance sheets, and assure the continuity of a strong, viable institution that can serve our people and our economy. Now, I understand that on any given day, Wall Street may be more comforted by an approach that gives bank bailouts with no strings attached and that holds nobody accountable for their reckless decisions. But such an approach won't solve the problem. And our goal is to quicken the day when we restart lending to the American people and American business and end this crisis once and for all. And I intend to hold these banks fully accountable for the assistance they receive, and this time they will have to clearly demonstrate how taxpayer dollars result in more lending for the American taxpayer. This time, CEOs won't be able to use taxpayer money to pad their paychecks or buy fancy drapes or disappear on a private jet. Those days are over.
Lots of applause for this pitch for corporate responsibility and new accountability.
Still, this plan will require significant resources from the federal government. And yes, probably more than we've already set aside. But while the cost of action will be great, I can assure you that the cost of inaction will be far greater. For it could result in an economy that sputters along for not months or years, but perhaps a decade. That would be worse for our deficit, worse for business, worse for you, and worse for the next generation, and I refuse to let that happen. I understand that when the last administration asked this Congress to provide assistance for struggling banks, Democrats and Republicans alike were infuriated by the mismanagement and the results that followed. So were the American taxpayers. So was I. So I know how unpopular it is to be seen as helping banks right now, especially when everyone is suffering in part from their bad decisions. I promise you, I get it. But I also know that in a time of crisis, we cannot afford to govern out of anger or yield to the politics of the moment. My job, our job, is to solve the problem. Our job is to govern with a sense of responsibility. I will not spend a single penny for the purpose of rewarding a single Wall Street executive. But I will do whatever it takes to help the small business that can't pay its workers or the family that has saved and still can't get a mortgage. That's what this is about. It's not about helping banks. It's about helping people. It's not about helping banks. It's about helping people, because when credit is available again, that young family can finally buy a new home. And then some company will hire workers to build it. And then those workers will have money to spend. And if they can get a loan too, maybe they'll finally buy that car or open their own business. Investors will return to the market. And American families will see their retirement secured once more. Slowly but surely, confidence will return, and our economy will recover. So So I ask this Congress to join me in doing whatever proves necessary, because we cannot consign our nation to an open-ended recession. And to ensure that a crisis of this magnitude never happens again, I ask Congress to move quickly on legislation that will finally reform our outdated regulatory system. It is time. It is time. It is time to put in place tough, new common sense rules of the road so that our financial market rewards drive and innovation and punishes shortcuts and abuse. The recovery plan and the financial stability plan are the immediate steps we're taking to revive our economy in the short term. But the only way to fully restore America's economic strength is to make the long-term investments that will lead to new jobs, new industries, and a renewed ability to compete with the rest of the world. The only way this century will be another American century is if we confront at last the price of our dependence on oil and the high cost of health care, the schools that aren't preparing our children, and the mountain of debt they stand to inherit. That is our responsibility. In the next few days, I will submit a budget to Congress. So often, we've come to view these documents as simply numbers on a page or a laundry list of programs. I see this document differently. I see it as a vision for America, as a blueprint for our future. My budget does not attempt to solve every problem or address every issue. It reflects the stark reality of what we've inherited, a trillion-dollar deficit, a financial crisis, and a costly recession. Given these realities, everyone in this chamber, Democrats and Republicans, will have to sacrifice some worthy priorities for which there are no dollars. And that includes me. But that does not mean we can afford to ignore our long-term challenges. I reject the view that says our problems will simply take care of themselves, that says government has no role in laying the foundation for our common prosperity. For history tells a different story. History reminds us that at every moment of economic upheaval and transformation, this nation has responded with bold action and big ideas. In the midst of civil war, we laid railroad tracks from one coast to another that spurred commerce and industry. From the turmoil of the Industrial Revolution came a system of public high schools that prepared our citizens for a new age. In the wake of war and depression, the GI Bill sent a generation to college and created the largest middle class in history. And a twilight struggle for freedom led to a nation of highways, an American on the moon, and an explosion of technology that still shapes our world. In each case, government didn't supplant private enterprise. It catalyzed private enterprise. It created the conditions for thousands of entrepreneurs and new businesses to adapt and to thrive. We are a nation that has seen promise amid peril and claimed opportunity from ordeal. Now we must be that nation again. That is why, even as it cuts back on programs we don't need, the budget I submit will invest in the three areas that are absolutely critical to our economic future: energy, health care, and education. It begins with energy. We know the country that harnesses the power of clean, renewable energy will lead the 21st century. And yet it is China that has launched the largest effort in history to make their economy energy efficient. We invented solar technology, but we've fallen behind countries like Germany and Japan in producing it. New plug-in hybrids roll off our assembly lines, but they will run on batteries made in Korea. Well, I do not accept a future where the jobs and industries of tomorrow take root beyond our borders, and I know you don't either. It is time for America to lead again. thanks to our recovery plan, we will double this nation's supply of renewable energy in the next 3 years. We've also made the largest investment in basic research funding in American history, an investment that will spur not only new discoveries in energy, but breakthroughs in medicine and science and technology. We will soon lay down thousands of miles of power lines that can carry new energy to cities and towns across this country. And we will put Americans to work, making our homes and buildings more efficient so that we can save billions of dollars on our energy bills. But to truly transform our economy, to protect our security and save our planet from the ravages of climate change, we need to ultimately make clean, renewable energy the profitable kind of energy. So I ask this Congress to send me legislation that places a market-based cap on carbon pollution and drives the production of more renewable energy in America. That's what we need. And to support that innovation, we will invest $15 billion a year to develop technologies like wind power and solar power, advanced biofuels, clean coal, and more efficient cars and trucks built right here in America. Speaking of our auto industry, everyone recognizes that years of bad decision-making and a global recession have pushed our automakers to the brink. We should not and will not protect them from their own bad practices. But we are committed to the goal of a retooled, reimagined auto industry that can compete and win. Millions of jobs depend on it, scores of communities depend on it, and I believe the nation that invented the automobile cannot walk away from it. None of this will come without cost, nor will it be easy. But this is America. We don't do what's easy. We do what's necessary to move this country forward. And for that same reason, we must also address the crushing cost of health care. There's a cost that now causes a bankruptcy in America every 30 seconds. By the end of the year, it could cause 1.5 million Americans to lose their homes. In the last 8 years, premiums have grown four times faster than wages. And in each of these years, 1 million more Americans have lost their health insurance. It is one of the major reasons why small businesses close their doors and corporations ship jobs overseas. And it is one of the largest and fastest growing parts of our budget. Given these facts, we can no longer afford to put health care reform on hold. We can't afford to do it. It's time. Already, we've done more to advance the cause of health care reform in the last 30 days than we've done in the last decade. When it was days old, this Congress passed a law to provide and protect health insurance for 11 million American children whose parents work full-time. Our recovery plan will invest in electronic health records, a new technology that will reduce errors, bring down costs, ensure privacy, and save lives. It will launch a new effort to conquer a disease that has touched the life of nearly every American, including me, by seeking a cure for cancer in our time. And it makes the largest investment ever in preventive care, because that's one of the best ways to keep our people healthy and our costs under control. This budget builds on these reforms. It includes a historic commitment to comprehensive health care reform, a down payment on the principle that we must have quality, affordable health care for every American. It's a commitment. It's a commitment that's paid for in part by efficiencies in our system that are long overdue. And it's a step we must take if we hope to bring down our deficit in the years to come. Now, there will be many different opinions and ideas about how to achieve reform. And that's why I'm bringing together businesses and workers, doctors and healthcare providers, Democrats and Republicans, to begin work on this issue next week. I suffer no illusions that this will be an easy process. Once again, it will be hard. But I also know that nearly a century after Teddy Roosevelt first called for reform, the cost of our health care has weighed down our economy and our conscience long enough. So let there be no doubt. Health care reform cannot wait, it must not wait, and it will not wait another year. The third challenge we must address is the urgent need to expand the promise of education in America. In a global economy where the most valuable skill you can sell is your knowledge, a good education is no longer just a pathway to opportunity, it is a prerequisite. Right now, 3/4 of the fastest growing occupations require more than a high school diploma. And yet, just over half of our citizens have that level of education. We have one of the highest high school dropout rates of any industrialized nation, and half of the students who begin college never finish. This is a prescription for economic decline, because we know the countries that outteach us today will outcompete us tomorrow. And that is why it will be the goal of this administration to ensure that every child has access to a complete and competitive education from the day they are born to the day they begin a career. That is a promise we have to make to the children of America. Already we've made historic investment in education through the Economic Recovery Plan. We dramatically expanded early childhood education and will continue to improve its quality because we know that the most formative learning comes in those first years of life. We've made college affordable for nearly 7 million more students. 7 million. And we have provided the resources necessary to prevent painful cuts and teacher layoffs that would set back our children's progress. But we know that our schools don't just need more resources, they need more reform. And that is why this budget creates new incentives for teacher performance, pathways for advancement, and rewards for success. We'll invest in innovative programs that are already helping schools meet high standards and close achievement gaps. And we will expand our commitment to charter schools. It is our responsibility as lawmakers and as educators to make this system work. But it is the responsibility of every citizen to participate in it. So tonight I ask every American to commit to at least 1 year or more of higher education or career training. This can be a community college or a 4-year school, vocational training or an apprenticeship. But whatever the training may be, every American will need to get more than a high school diploma. And dropping out of high school is no longer an option. It's not just quitting on yourself, it's quitting on your country. And this country needs and values the talents of every American. That's why we will provide the support necessary for all young Americans to complete college and meet a new goal. By 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. That is a goal we can meet. That's a goal we can meet. Now, I know that the price of tuition is higher than ever, which is why if you are willing to volunteer in your neighborhood or give back to your community or serve your country, we will make sure that you can afford a higher education. And to encourage a renewed spirit of national service for this and future generations, I ask Congress to send me the bipartisan legislation that bears the name of Senator Orrin Hatch, as well as an American who has never stopped asking what he can do for his country, Senator Edward Kennedy.
And loud cheers there for both of those senators, and no doubt, especially for Senator Kennedy, who, as we know, has been suffering from brain cancer and I believe is not in the chamber tonight. Senator Orrin Hatch is there, and both men now getting the accolades of their colleagues.
These education policies will open the doors of opportunity for our children. But it is up to us to ensure they walk through them. In the end, there is no program or policy that can substitute for a parent, for a mother or father who will attend those parent-teacher conferences, or help with homework, or turn off the TV, put away the video games, read to their child. I speak to you not just as a president, but as a father, when I say that responsibility for our children's education must begin at home. That is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. That's an American issue. There is, of course, another responsibility we have to our children, and that's the responsibility to ensure that we do not pass on to them a debt they cannot pay. That is critical. See, I know we can get some consensus in here. With the deficit we inherited, the cost of the crisis we face and the long-term challenges we must meet, it has never been more important to ensure that as our economy recovers, we do what it takes to bring this deficit down. That is critical. Now, I'm proud that we passed a recovery plan free of earmarks. And I want to pass a budget next year that ensures that each dollar we spend reflects only our most important national priorities. And yesterday, I held a fiscal summit where I pledged to cut the deficit in half by the end of my first term in office. My administration has also begun to go line by line through the federal budget in order to eliminate wasteful and ineffective programs. As you can imagine, there's a process that will take some time, but we have already identified $2 trillion in savings over the next decade. In this budget, we will end education programs that don't work and end direct payments to large agribusiness that don't need them. We'll eliminate the no-bid contracts that have wasted billions in Iraq. And reform our defense budget so that we're not paying for Cold War era weapon systems we don't use. We will root out the waste and fraud and abuse in our Medicare program that doesn't make our seniors any healthier. We will restore a sense of fairness and balance to our tax code by finally ending the tax breaks for corporations that ship our jobs overseas. In order to save our children from a future of debt, we will also end the tax breaks for the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Now, let me be clear. Let me be absolutely clear, because I know you'll end up hearing some of the same claims that rolling back these tax breaks means a massive tax increase on the American people. If your family earns less than $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year, you will not see your taxes increased a single dime. I repeat, not one single dime. In fact, not a dime. In fact, the recovery plan provides a tax cut. That's right, a tax cut for 95% of working families. And by the way, these checks are on the way.
I think we're starting to hear a little bit of partisan disagreement here. We are hearing a few Republican catcalls for some of the president's remarks here.
To preserve our long-term fiscal health, we must also address the growing cost in Medicare and Social Security. Comprehensive health care reform is the best way to strengthen Medicare for years to come. And we must also begin a conversation on how to do the same for Social Security while creating tax-free universal savings accounts for all Americans. Finally, because we're also suffering from a deficit of trust, I am committed to restoring a sense of honesty and accountability to our budget. That is why this budget looks ahead 10 years and accounts for spending that was left out under the old rules. And for the first time, that includes the full cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. For 7 years, we've been a nation at war. No longer will we hide its price. Along with our outstanding national security team, I am now carefully reviewing our policies in both wars, and I will soon announce a way forward in Iraq that leaves Iraq to its people and responsibly ends this war. And with our friends and allies, we will forge a new and comprehensive strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan to defeat al-Qaeda and combat extremism, because I will not allow terrorists to plot against the American people from safe havens halfway around the world. We will not allow it. As we meet here tonight, our men and women in uniform stand watch abroad, and more are readying to deploy. To each and every one of them, and to the families who bear the quiet burden of their absence, Americans are united in sending one message. We honor your service. We are inspired by your sacrifice, and you have our unyielding support.
Sustained applause here. There are members of the Armed Services veterans from the wars in Iraq and I believe Afghanistan in the gallery along with the First Lady tonight in uniform, and they're getting the applause, a standing ovation from all of those in the House chamber.
To relieve the strain on our forces, my budget increases the number of our soldiers and Marines. And to keep our sacred trust with those who serve, we will raise their pay and give our veterans the expanded health care and benefits that they have earned. to overcome extremism, we must also be vigilant in upholding the values our troops defend. Because there is no force in the world more powerful than the example of America. And that is why I have ordered the closing of the detention center at Guantanamo Bay and will seek swift and certain justice for captured terrorists. Because living our values doesn't make us weaker, it makes us safer, and it makes us stronger. And that is why I can stand here tonight and say without exception or equivocation that the United States of America does not torture. We can make that commitment here tonight. In words and deeds, we are showing the world that a new era of engagement has begun. For we know that America cannot meet the threats of this century alone, but the world cannot meet them without America. We cannot shun the negotiating table, nor ignore the foes or forces that could do us harm. We are instead called to move forward with the sense of confidence and candor that serious times demand. To seek progress towards a secure and lasting peace between Israel and her neighbors, we have appointed an envoy to sustain our effort, to meet the challenges of the 21st century, from terrorism to nuclear proliferation, from pandemic disease to cyber threats to crushing poverty. We will strengthen old alliances, forge new ones, and use all elements of our national power. And to respond to an economic crisis that is global in scope, we are working with the nations of the G20 to restore confidence in our financial system, avoid the possibility of escalating protectionism, and spur demand for American goods in markets across the globe. For the world depends on us having a strong economy, just as our economy depends on the strength of the world's. As we stand at this crossroads of history, the eyes of all people in all nations are once again upon us, watching to see what we do with this moment, waiting for us to lead. Those of us gathered here tonight have been called to govern in extraordinary times. It is a tremendous burden, but also a great privilege, one that has been entrusted to few generations of Americans. For in our hands lies the ability to shape our world, for good or for ill. I know that it's easy to lose sight of this truth, to become cynical and doubtful, consumed with the petty and the trivial. But in my life, I have also learned that hope is found in unlikely places, that inspiration often comes not from those with the most power or celebrity, but from the dreams and aspirations of ordinary Americans who are anything but ordinary. I think of Leonard Abbas, a bank president from Miami who reportedly cashed out of his company, took a $60 million bonus and gave it out to all 399 people who worked for him, plus another 72 who used to work for him. He didn't tell anyone, but when the local newspaper found out, he simply said, "I knew some of these people since I was 7 years old. It didn't feel right getting the money myself."
And applause in the chamber as people turn to look at Leonard Abbas, the bank president whom the president was speaking of there, who is in the gallery shaking hands with those sitting next to him, I believe including one of those employees who got some of that money from Mr. Abbas.
I think about Greensburg, Kansas, a town that was completely destroyed by a tornado, but is being rebuilt by its residents as a global example of how clean energy can power an entire community, how it can bring jobs and businesses to a place where piles of bricks and rubble once lay. "The tragedy was terrible," said one of the men who helped them rebuild. "But the folks here know that it also provided an incredible opportunity." I think about Tashea Bethea, the young girl from that school I visited in Dillon, South Carolina, the place where the ceilings leak, the paint peels off the walls, and they have to stop teaching 6 times a day because the train barrels by their classroom. She had been told that her school is hopeless. But the other day after class, she went to the public library and typed up a letter to the people sitting in this chamber. She even asked her principal for the money to buy a stamp. The letter asks us for help and says, "We are just students trying to become lawyers, doctors, congressmen like yourself, and one day president, so we can make a change to not just the state of South Carolina, but also the world. We are not quitters." That's what she said. "We are not quitters." These words.
And that eighth grader is there in the chamber sitting right next to the First Lady, Michelle Obama, who is giving her a hug. She's standing to receive the applause of the chamber. An eighth grader from South Carolina there in Congress tonight to hear the president read her words from the letter that she sent asking for help for her school in Dillon, South Carolina.
These words and these stories tell us something about the spirit of the people who sent us here. They tell us that even in the most trying times, amid the most difficult circumstances, there is a generosity, a resilience, a decency, and a determination that perseveres, a willingness to take responsibility for our future and for posterity. Their resolve must be our inspiration. Their concerns must be our cause. And we must show them and all our people that we are equal to the task before us. I know that we haven't agreed on every issue thus far. There are surely times in the future where we will part ways. But I also know that every American who is sitting here tonight loves this country and wants it to succeed. I know that. That must be the starting point for every debate we have in the coming months, and where we return after those debates are done. That is the foundation on which the American people expect us to build common ground. And if we do, if we come together and lift this nation from the depths of this crisis, if we put our people back to work and restart the engine of our prosperity, if we confront without fear the challenges of our time and summon that enduring spirit of an America that does not quit, then someday, years from now, our children can tell their children that this was the time when we performed, in the words that are carved into this very chamber, something worthy to be remembered. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
We've been listening to President Barack Obama speaking tonight in the U.S. Capitol before a joint session of Congress. He spoke for just under 52 minutes, focusing primarily on the economic crisis and seeking to create a sense of confidence in the path he's laid out. He said, "We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before." The president's economic stimulus plan, of course, received almost no Republican support, but the president expressed hope for what he called common ground going forward. And later this week, the president will submit his first budget to Congress, what he called a blueprint for our future, and that we know will have many of the details that the president did not give tonight. As the president waves to the members of the House and Senate at the end of his speech and prepares to make his way through the chamber, we're going to turn again to our reporters, NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson and economics correspondent John Idsty. Mara, thoughts on the speech from what we just heard and what you were expecting to hear?
Well, I thought it was a very determined and plain-spoken speech. I think that he laid out a clear argument for why he did what he's already done with the stimulus, with the bank bailout, which is still a work in progress, and with the financial re-regulation that is yet to come. He was pretty honest. He said, this is going to require significant resources, and yes, more than we've already set aside. This is the question that he's been asked, and White House aides have been asked many times. When are you going to finally level with the American people and say the bailouts are going to be even more expensive? There'll be another tranche asked for. He said, yes.
Probably more than we've already set aside. Yeah.
I thought that he addressed the issue of fear and panic. He had an FDR-like paragraph where he said, look, you should know the money you've deposited in banks is safe, your insurance is secure, you know, you can rely on the continued operation of our financial system. That's not the problem. The problem is this credit crisis. And he tried to explain why bailing out the banks was for everyone, not just bankers. He clearly tried to put himself on the side of the populist anger against CEOs. And when it came to the agenda going forward, he laid out three pretty clear areas. Well, four: energy, healthcare, education, and deficit reduction. On energy, he called for a carbon cap this year. And I thought on healthcare costs, that was something that I thought was actually the most revealing. He said that his budget was going to include a down payment, not universal coverage, but a down payment on the principle that we must have quality, affordable health care. He didn't wave one of those cards in the air like President Clinton saying, if you don't give me universal coverage, I'll veto the bill. He talked about costs. Health care costs is the first priority, getting the cost of health care down. And that's kind of the key that unlocks the entitlement problem and the deficit problem.
Also, they're saying that he knows this process will not be easy. It will be hard, but he said healthcare reform cannot wait. It must not wait, and it will not wait another year. Obviously, the big question there that we'll continue discussing is what form that takes. And we didn't, I think, get to education or the deficit, which we were talking about. Let's bring John Isdy, our economics correspondent, in this. John, before the speech, we were talking about sort of echoes of FDR, and Mara mentioned that fireside chat from 1933 where President Roosevelt was assuring people it's safer to keep your money in a reopened bank than it is to keep it under the mattress. I mean, there were echoes of that today, but obviously taken to a different level with President Obama stressing that's not the issue. The issue is we got to get the pipes flowing again.
That's right. I think he was trying to make the case for money flowing to the banks by saying that we've done this stimulus, but the stimulus is not enough. And in fact, it will be it won't work unless we get credit flowing again. And in doing so, I thought it was one of the most interesting passages in his speech, and Mara referred to it. He says it's not about helping banks, it's about helping people, because when credit is available again, that young family can finally buy a new home, and then some company will hire workers to build it, and those workers will have money to spend, and they can get a loan too, maybe, and buy a car and open a business. And he's actually kind of painting a picture of a recovery. And, you know, it strikes me that this may be the first time he's actually done walked it through. And, you know, I think people need that right now. They are bludgeoned by all the dire news about the economy, and they just want a picture of what can be.
Yeah, what does it mean for me? Also, interesting, too, that line sort of got swallowed in applause, and he repeated it. He wanted to make sure that that line came through loud and clear. This is not about banks, it's about people. And when he talked about popular anger about the bank bailout, he said, believe me, I get it. And let's bring our political commentators in here as well. Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard and E.J. Dion of the Washington Post. Matt, did it strike you that that was sort of one of the key nuggets of the address, that he was addressing that anger? He knew he had to address it, that popular anger has been key. And though he does have support in the polls, he needs to take that on.
He did. And, you know, it's a hard hat trick to pull, right? You have to convince all Americans who are seething with anger at their irresponsible elites that the way that they're eventually going to get this economic recovery is by aiding the same irresponsible elites that put him there in the first place. But, you know, one thing that struck me, if the Obama administration needed a mantra, it has one right now. And the mantra is responsibility. We heard that word dozens and dozens and dozens of times, the responsibility of government, but also the responsibility of the citizens. And I think that will be a continuing theme in Obama's speeches this year. One other thing that struck me, foreign policy got short shrift.
Yeah.
He confined it to a few paragraphs toward the end of the speech. And basically on the two wars, on Iraq and Afghanistan, his message was, I'll get back to you on that. I'm going to have my plan later this week on how to end the war. And then my administration is continuing this review of how to deal with Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pakistan. And what struck me about it was George Bush clearly thought of himself as a war president. I'm not so sure Barack Obama does. I think his top priority is domestic affairs.
President Obama is signing autographs as he makes his way through the chamber, a lengthy departure, and I should say that we are awaiting the Republican response from Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. We'll bring that to you in its entirety. And as we wait for that, I'm going to bring E.J. Dionne into the conversation. E.J. Dionne, we were talking about addressing anger and taking on corporate accountability, corporate responsibility. Did it strike you that that message was effective tonight in the president's remarks?
Well, you know, when he was talking about banking, I thought he sounded like George Bailey, the good banker, and It's a Wonderful Life. Your money is doing this. It's going to his house. And what he made clear is he was against Mr. Potter, the bad banker, in It's a Wonderful Life. And I think he drew that distinction successfully.
Implicitly.
Yes, not explicitly. That's true. I think that the large message here is that just as Ronald Reagan began a new conservative era in the midst of a crisis, I think Barack Obama made plain he is going to lead us into a new progressive era in the midst of the crisis we're in now. I reject the view, he said, that says our problems will simply take care of themselves, that says government has no role in laying the foundation for our common prosperity. Government, he says, said catalyzes private enterprise. That was his rendezvous with FDR. And he you know, we're going to talk about how big an agenda he has, but it was also very focused when you think about it. It was health care reform, greener energy, and education,
plus that deficit reduction.
Those are big things, but that's what he's focusing on. I was reading the other night an Arthur Schlesinger essay on cycles in American history, and there are periods when we focus on private interest and periods when we focus on public endeavor. And I think Matt's exactly right about that word responsibility. It's a favorite Obama theme. It was very much there in the inaugural address, and I think he's talking about responsible public endeavor in this speech.
He used this phrase at the very beginning of his speech. He called it the day of reckoning that has come. I'm talking about hard choices in this speech. And it did strike me that this, of course, not being billed as a State of the Union per se, but it is essentially his accounting of the State of the Union and where we are now. Very different sort of address than we're used to hearing. Not big red meat applause lines. The applause, although it came fairly frequently, was fairly brief. There was not a lot really to applaud here in terms of what's going on that's positive right now.
And you got the sense sometimes that Obama didn't want that much applause.
Yeah.
He sometimes talked over the applause.
He did.
He's very good at that. That's actually a rhetorical trick of his.
But you don't think that's a mistake.
Often it's not a mistake, but clearly he did want to convey the seriousness. One thing that strikes me, EJ is absolutely right. He limited his goals to these three sectors, energy, healthcare, and education. But as I'm sitting there listening to the speech, I'm thinking, okay, well, what three sectors of our economy has the government been most involved in over the past 30, 40, even longer years? It's energy, healthcare, and education. And we see there, I think, that government interventions in the past have sometimes only complicated or exacerbated or done nothing to resolve these problems.
You mean like providing health care for every American
over the age of 65 years old? I'll give you an example. The problem with our health care system is because it's tied to employment, right? And that started with FDR during wartime rationing there, a government intervention there. Energy. Carter gave his first speech as president on his energy plan 30 years ago. Well, we're still dealing with those problems because of the distortions that government creates. And then, of course, education, too. We need reform, absolutely, but it has to be accountability. And that's something that I'm afraid won't be stressed in these Obama budgets.
We did hear more, I think, in that section, and we mentioned this during the speech, that when the president started talking about tax cuts and ending tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, that was a point at which I was hearing Republican catcalls. Clearly, those are divisive issues in the Congress. It will not be easily resolved. And, you know, the budget looking forward and what cuts will be made, he said, we're all going to have to shed some of our priorities, including me. Those are going to be big fights to come.
Yeah, very big fights. And, you know, he's been making this argument ever since the campaign. And he said, you know, we know that the other guys are going to say that rolling back or letting these tax cuts expire, which is what he plans to do. He has changed his mind from the campaign that he would actually stop them early, means a tax increase. In fact, as long as you earn less than $250,000, which sounds a lot bigger than $250,000, you won't see your taxes increased a single dime. Now, these checks, as he said, are going out on April 1st. People are going to get a little bit more every week
in their paychecks.
The big question is, are they going to feel it or not? Now, one of the reasons that the
White House argued that this tax cut would be a stimulus as opposed to the rebate that Congress gave everybody and they just put it in their pocket or used it to pay off their credit cards last year is because they're doling it out in little bits, like an intravenous drip of extra, I think it's about $14 a week.
John, it's Dean.
Actually, yeah. Less than that.
Less than that now. It got cut back.
No, because it's starting late this year. It's $14 a week this year, but next year it'll be $7 or $8 a week. Yep. So small, you won't notice it, is the theory, but that's pretty small.
Well, no, you're
so it's hard to imagine.
Certainly, the White House hopes that people notice it.
But then I know they do, but they don't want them to notice it enough so they take it and save it.
Right. They want to go ahead and spend it. Yeah. John, the other question, and the president raised this, is the main point here, though, is jobs. And that's exactly what that stimulus package is supposed to do. The money should be heading out to the states. How soon? What do we think the ultimate impact and how quickly that will
be? I saw something yesterday, I believe, that Medicaid dollars would be immediately, something like $15 billion worth of Medicaid dollars would be available almost immediately. And I think that this money will be going out very quickly. Certainly jobs are the big issue, and saving jobs is what will happen if the states get a hold of this money and can hang on to some of their employees. One other thing that I noticed in this speech was the president really stood behind the auto companies, even though popular sentiment has sort of turned against them and giving them more money. He said, the nation that invented automobiles cannot walk away from them.
And you had a quibble with that statement.
Well, I did, and I Googled it, and indeed Carl Benz of Germany is credited with inventing the automobile.
So it should be the Germans not walking away
from
the auto industry.
We do not want the Germans to walk away from the automobile industry.
As we wait in a few moments here for the Republican response to the president's address coming from the Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, an interesting choice, especially given the fact that he has said he will not take some of the stimulus money that should be headed his way. E.J. Dionne, what are you looking for from Governor Jindal tonight?
Well, you know, it's interesting that as soon as Governor Jindal did that, he came under enormous attack. It is very odd that the one thing he won't take money for is unemployment compensation. And a lot of people are wondering why. Is it for political reasons that the governor—
He's saying it would tie the hands of the state.
Right. And that the question, it wouldn't really tie the hands of the state. And there'll be a lot of people who won't get unemployment compensation because of that. Senator Schumer came out with a letter either yesterday or today saying under the terms of the stimulus bill, you have to either take it all or reject it all. And so it'll be an interesting fight. You can't pick and choose. But I think that a lot of Republicans are looking to Jindal as a kind of savior, because he is young, he is smart. And I think up to now, he's looked like a strong conservative who was not particularly ideological. The way he's playing with this stimulus bill, it looks like he is bidding very clearly for the Republican right, particularly the economic Republican
right. Although he's certainly dodged around the question of will he be a candidate in 2012. Bobby Jindal, 37 years old, son of Indian immigrants from Punjab, only in the governor's mansion there in Baton Rouge, which is where he'll be speaking from tonight, for a little over a year. Matt Continetti, the great hope of the Republican Party?
The great hope of some. There are several great hopes out there that various factions of the party like, and Jindal is certainly the wonkiest of them, and there is certainly the opening bid of the 2012 Republican primary in Jindal's statement that he doesn't want to take some of this stimulus money. I think the Republicans will still be debating the stimulus 4 years from now, regardless of whether we've had an economic recovery.
There have certainly been Republican governors who said, you don't want the money?
Right.
I'll take it. Governor
Charlie Crist in Florida, and of course the governator in California who desperately needs the money.
And we're just about a minute away from the governor's speech here, so we should be not step on it. But finish your thought, Matt. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I would go back to something that EJ was saying, you know, about leading us to the new liberal era, Obama identifying, you know, he doesn't believe that we need to. He's against this idea that, you know, our problems will feel themselves. I get the sense when Obama said heal themselves, when Obama says that, you know, he's really grappling with the straw man. Mm-hmm. I mean, he needs to be more realistic about the real ideological differences, even though we don't like that word anymore, that exist in America today.
Okay. Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, along with NPR's Mara Liasson and John Idsty, as we await the Republican response from Baton Rouge, from Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, speaking from the governor's mansion in Baton Rouge, responding to President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress. Here's the governor.
Good evening and happy Mardi Gras. I'm Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana. Tonight, we witnessed a great moment in the history of our republic. In the very chamber where Congress once voted to abolish slavery, our first African-American president stepped forward to address the state of our union. With his speech tonight, the president completed a redemptive journey that took our nation from Independence Hall to Gettysburg to the lunch counter, and now finally, the Oval Office. Regardless of party, all Americans are moved by the president's personal story. The son of an American mother and a Kenyan father who grew up to become leader of the free world. Like the president's father, my own parents came to this country from a distant land. When they arrived in Baton Rouge, my mother was already 4.5 months pregnant. I was what folks in the insurance industry now call a pre-existing condition. To find work, my dad picked up the Yellow Pages and started calling local businesses. Even after landing a job, he still couldn't afford to pay for my delivery, so he worked out an installment plan with the doctor. Fortunately for me, he never missed a payment. As I grew up, my mom and dad taught me the values that attracted them to this country, and they instilled in me an immigrant's wonder at the greatness of America. As a child, I remember going to the grocery store with my dad. Growing up in India, he had seen extreme poverty. As we walked through the aisles, looking at the endless variety on the shelves, he would tell me, "Bobby, Americans can do anything." I still believe that to this day. Americans can do anything. When we pull together, there is no challenge we can't overcome. As the president made clear this evening, we're now in a time of challenge. Many of you listening tonight have lost jobs. Others have seen your college and your retirement savings dwindle. Many of you are worried about losing your health care and your homes. You're looking to your elected leaders in Washington for solutions. Republicans are ready to work with a new president to provide these solutions. Here in my state of Louisiana, we don't care what party you belong to if you have good ideas to make life better for our people. We need more of that attitude from both Democrats and Republicans in our nation's capital. All of us want our economy to recover and our nation to prosper. So where we agree, Republicans must be the president's strongest partners. And where we disagree, Republicans have a responsibility to be candid and offer better ideas for a path forward. Today in Washington, some are promising that government will rescue us from the economic storms raging all around us. Those of us who lived through Hurricane Katrina, we have our doubts. Let me tell you a story. During Katrina, I visited Sheriff Harry Lee, a Democrat and a good friend of mine. When I walked into his makeshift office, I had never seen him so angry. He was literally yelling into the phone, "Well, I'm the sheriff, and if you don't like it, you can come and arrest me." I asked him, "Sheriff, what's got you so mad?" He told me that he put out a call for volunteers to come with their boats to rescue people who were trapped on their rooftops by the floodwaters. The boats were all lined up and ready to go. And then some bureaucrat showed up and told them they couldn't go out in the water unless they had proof of insurance and registration. And I told him, "Sheriff, that's ridiculous." Before I knew it, he was yelling on the phone, "Congressman Jindal is here, and he says you can come and arrest him too." There he just told those boaters, ignore the bureaucrats and go start rescuing people. There's a lesson in this experience. The strength of America is not found in our government. It is found in the compassionate hearts and the enterprising spirit of our citizens. We're grateful for the support we've received from across the nation for our ongoing recovery efforts. This spirit got Louisiana through the hurricanes, and this spirit will get our nation through the storms we face today. To solve our current problems, Washington must lead. But the way to lead is not to raise taxes, not to just put more money and power in the hands of Washington politicians. The way to lead is by empowering you, the American people, because we believe that Americans can do anything. That's why Republicans put forward plans to create jobs by lowering income tax rates for working families, cutting taxes for small businesses, strengthening incentives for businesses to invest in new equipment and to hire new workers, and stabilizing home values by creating a new tax credit for homebuyers. These plans would cost less and create more jobs. But Democratic leaders in Congress, they rejected this approach. Instead of trusting us to make decisions with our own money, they passed the largest government spending bill in history, with a price tag of more than $1 trillion with interest. While some of the projects in the bill make sense, Their legislation is larded with wasteful spending. It includes $300 million to buy new cars for the government, $8 billion for high-speed rail projects such as a magnetic levitation line from Las Vegas to Disneyland, and $140 million for something called volcano monitoring. Instead of monitoring volcanoes, what Congress should be monitoring is the eruption of spending in Washington, D.C. Democratic leaders say their legislation will grow the economy. What it will do is grow the government, increase our taxes down the line, and saddle future generations with debt. Who amongst us would ask our children for a loan so we could spend money we do not have on things we do not need? That is precisely what the Democrats in Congress just did. It's irresponsible. And it's no way to strengthen our economy, create jobs, or build a prosperous future for our children. In Louisiana, we took a different approach. Since I became governor, we cut more than 250 earmarks from their state budget. To create jobs for our citizens, we cut taxes six times, including the largest income tax cut in the history of our state. We passed those tax cuts with bipartisan majorities. Republicans and Democrats put aside their differences. We work together to make sure our people can keep more of what they earn. If it can be done in Baton Rouge, surely it can be done in Washington, D.C. To strengthen our economy, we need urgent action to keep energy prices down. All of us remember what it felt like to pay $4 at the pump. Unless we act now, those prices will return. To stop that from happening, we need to increase conservation, increase energy efficiency, increase the use of alternative and renewable fuels, increase our use of nuclear power, and increase drilling for oil and gas here at home. We believe that Americans can do anything. And if we unleash that innovative spirit of our citizens, we can achieve energy independence. To strengthen our economy, we also need to address the crisis in health care. Republicans believe in a simple principle. No American should have to worry about losing their health care coverage, period. We stand for universal access to affordable health care coverage. What we oppose is universal government-run health care. Health care decisions should be made by doctors and patients, not by government bureaucrats. We believe Americans can do anything. And if we put aside partisan politics and work together, we can make our system of private medicine affordable and accessible for every one of our citizens. To strengthen our economy, we also need to make sure that every child in America gets the best possible education. After Hurricane Katrina, we reinvented the New Orleans school system, opening dozens of new charter schools and creating a new scholarship program that is giving parents the chance to send their children to private or parochial schools of their choice. We believe that with a proper education, the children of America can do anything. And it shouldn't take a devastating storm to bring this kind of innovation to education in our country. To strengthen our economy, we must promote confidence in America by ensuring ours is the most ethical and transparent system in the world. In my home state, there used to be a saying, at any given time, half of Louisiana was said to be half underwater and the other half under indictment. Nobody says that anymore. Last year, we passed some of the strongest ethics laws in the nation, and today, Louisiana has turned her back on the corruption of the past. We need to bring transparency to Washington, D.C., so we can rid our capital of corruption and ensure that we never see the passage of another $1 trillion spending bill that Congress hasn't even read and the American people haven't even seen. As we take these steps, we must remember for all of our troubles at home, dangerous enemies still seek our destruction. Now is no time to dismantle the defenses that have protected this country for hundreds of years or to make deep cuts in funding for our troops. America's fighting men and women can do anything. If we give them the resources they need, they will stay on the offensive, defeat our enemies, and protect us from harm. In all these areas, Republicans want to work with President Obama. We appreciate his message of hope. But sometimes, it seems like we look for hope in different places. Democratic leaders in Washington, they place their hope in the federal government. We place our hope in you, the American people. In the end, it comes down to an honest and fundamental disagreement about the proper role of government. We oppose the National Democratic view that says the way to strengthen our country is to increase dependence on government. We believe the way to strengthen our country is to restrain spending in Washington, to empower individuals and small businesses to grow our economy and to create jobs. In recent years, these distinctions in philosophy became less clear. Our party got away from its principles. You elected Republicans to champion limited government, fiscal discipline, and personal responsibility. Instead, Republicans went along with earmarks and big government spending in Washington. Republicans lost your trust, and rightly so. Tonight, on behalf of our leaders in Congress and my fellow Republican governors, I say this. Our party is determined to regain your trust. We will do so by standing up for the principles that we share, the principles you elected us to fight for, the principles that built this in the greatest, most prosperous country on earth. You know, a few weeks ago, the president warned that our country is facing a crisis that he said, in quotes, we may not be able to reverse. You know, our troubles are real, to be sure. But don't let anyone tell you that we cannot recover. Don't let anyone tell you that America's best days are behind her. This is the nation that cast off the scourge of slavery, overcame the Great Depression, prevailed in two world wars, won the struggle for civil rights, defeated the Soviet menace, and responded with determined courage to the attacks of September 11th, 2001. The American spirit has triumphed over almost every form of adversity known to man, and the American spirit will triumph again. We can have confidence in our future, because amid all of today's challenges, we also count many blessings. We have the most innovative citizens, the most abundant resources, the most resilient economy, the most powerful military, and the freest political system in the history of the world. My fellow citizens, never forget, we are Americans. And like my dad said years ago, Americans can do anything. Thank you for listening. God bless you. God bless Louisiana, and God bless America.
We've been listening to Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal delivering the Republican response to President Obama's address to Congress. Governor Jindal was at the governor's mansion in Baton Rouge, along with wishing his listeners a happy Mardi Gras on this Fat Tuesday, telling a story of the colorful sheriff of Jefferson Parish, Harry Lee, and the reaction during Hurricane Katrina, the point being that government bureaucracy is no substitute for personal action, and a sharp critique of the stimulus package from Governor Jindal, calling it irresponsible and saddling future generations with debt. Governor Jindal said, "Who among us would ask our children for a loan so we could spend money we do not have on things we do not need?" That response coming again to the address from President Obama, who talked about his plan for economic recovery and sought to restore American confidence. The president spoke for about 52 minutes before a packed U.S. House chamber, lawmakers, members of the U.S. Supreme Court, and others. You've been listening to live special coverage of President Barack Obama's address to a joint session of Congress and the Republican response, special coverage from NPR News. And we're going to continue our coverage now. We are joined now from Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol by the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel. Mr. Emanuel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
It's Melissa, and
response... Oh, Melissa, I apologize.
No problem. Good to talk to you. Thanks
That's
for being
fair.
With us.
I apologize. No. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks. Your response to that critique from Governor Jindal there, we are spending money we do not have, he says, on things we do not need, saddling future generations with debt.
Well, first of all, as I know the governor knows, who, you know, we served together for a while, and as the president noted in his speech, we inherited the worst deficit in American history, and over the last 8 years, we accumulated $4.5 trillion of debt. So that problem that he's worried about was something that started about 8 years ago when there was a surplus.
But his point now is, what do we do about that?
And, as the president said, his budget cuts the deficit in half. Over 10 years, cuts $2 trillion from the nation's debt and makes key strategic investments in energy independence, health care reform, and access to higher education. That everything else is placed second to those priorities of putting our fiscal house in order and making key strategic investments, because those are going to be the essential investments for long-term economic growth. And that is what was involved in the American Recovery Act. Access to a college education, a $2,500 tax credit. Tripling the amount of energy we get from alternative energies, wind, solar, and other types of energy sources, and away from oil. And most importantly, in health care, making sure 11 million children get health care, and making sure that we make the investments in key areas like medical information technology that will save lives and save costs. And those are the foundations for long-term economic growth and making sure that we not only get out of this recession, but when we get out of it stronger and have more sustained economic growth.
But Mr. Manuel, looking forward in getting...
He was right. He was right. Mm-hmm. We'll take on more debt, but it's not the debt that is taken on here. That's everybody agrees, Democrat and Republican economists. That's what it's going to take to get out of this recession. But what do you do with that is key, which is you make strategic investments or do what happened before, which is these problems got worse, but we accumulated $4 trillion of debt.
You were key, Mr. Emanuel, in trying to forge or at least to get a few Republican votes in the Senate to get that stimulus
bill through.
You noticed, huh? Yeah, well, I've heard about it. You got three, and it's just what you needed. Yeah. But looking forward, with the big range of initiatives that the president was talking about tonight, you heard the Republican response in the chamber. What optimism do you have looking forward that you're going to get any bipartisan support for anything you want to do?
Well, first of all, we did get a lot of bipartisan support. 18 governors. Republican governors.
Not in the Congress.
So, but wait. No, but that's not the only place where Republicans count. 18 Republican governors, Governor Schwarzenegger out of California, Governor Crist out of Florida, Governor Huntsman, all supported this and continue to support what we did because they know it's essential to the economy.
So why don't you
Second
have that support in Congress, do you think?
Well, there's a difference between Republicans out in the country and Washington, D.C.-based Republicans. That's just the fundamental, and they decided opposition was what they wanted, but that doesn't mean we didn't have Republican support. We have support of Republican voters, and we have support of Republican governors, Republican mayors, and Republican legislatures. There's many ways to measure that. Number two is going forward on energy independence, you'll see Republicans support that. On health care reform, you'll see a different group of Republicans support that. We'll continue to reach out. That's why in the fiscal summit the president held yesterday, 60 members of Congress showed up. Many members of the Republican leadership showed up. We will continue to reach out. It's up to them if they want to also reach out and work with us. They didn't do that on the Recovery Act, but that does not mean, as the president said today, that he won't continue to try to reach out to them to seek cooperation on the future initiatives.
Okay. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel speaking with us from Statuary Hall at the U.S.
Capitol.
Thanks for being with us.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to go now to Democratic Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia. He joins us from the Executive Mansion in Richmond. Governor Kaine, welcome to the program.
Melissa, great to be with you.
You heard Rahm Emanuel there talking about your Republican brethren around the country and support that he feels the president has from them. As you take the pulse of governors around the country, where do you think they stand on the stimulus package and on the economic plan going forward?
Melissa, I was just spent 3 days with all the nation's governors in Washington, and we talked about the stimulus virtually nonstop, the stimulus in the economy. The overwhelming majority of Republican governors are thrilled that the president has acted with a sense of urgency. There are a few Republican governors who are saying they may not accept some small portion of the package, but most are counting on it to help them and their states get through this very difficult time. So I think Rahm was right. There's a disconnect between what's happening inside the Beltway and the way that governors and the citizens outside the Beltway are looking at this. We need to act and act now, and people appreciate what the president has done.
How much money does Virginia stand to get through the stimulus package?
Well, the various line items that are kind of spending items would be somewhere between $3 and $4 billion. But I want to underline something that is really important. This package cuts taxes on 95% of working households. If families that make less than $150,000 a year are going to get a tax cut under this plan. And one of the things in listening to Governor Jindal's speech, there's a suggestion that there isn't tax cuts. There are tax cuts for the bulk of American working families, and that is also going to be very helpful here in Virginia.
You, of course, wear another hat now. You're the new chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and I'm curious for your take on the public opinion polls that have been coming out leading up to this speech. The president seems to be enjoying maybe a slightly diminished level of support, but support nonetheless. Do you think that's sustainable as he moves forward with this range of plans, some of which are going to be unpopular?
Well, you know, I think he recognizes that the key isn't popularity, the key is results. But he's heartened to know that he has support of voters that are Democrat, but also Republican and independent. One of the polls that I saw today, it's a Washington Post ABC poll that I liked particularly, was a question of, do you think President Obama is sincerely reaching out to work with Republicans? And 70% of Americans said yes. There was then the question, are Republicans in Congress reaching out to work with the president? And only 35% said yes. I am doing all I can to encourage in this time of, you know, national crisis that the president and his team continue always to hold out that hand. We need to work together in this tough time, and that's the kind of president we have, so I'm sure that that's what they'll keep doing.
Governor Kaine, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely, Melissa.
It's Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, a Democrat. He's also chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And we're going now to Northern Virginia, Governor Kaine's state. NPR's Linda Wertheimer is there on the campus of George Mason University. She's with students who gathered to watch the president's speech to Congress tonight, Democrats and Republicans from Northern Virginia and from beyond. Linda, what kind of reaction did you hear from the students tonight?
Well, we heard a lot of people who wanted more detail than they got. We've heard people who had some criticisms of Mr. Obama before that were not particularly well satisfied by this speech. And then we had quite a few people here who are fans of Mr. Obama and liked the speech. And one of them is Gabe Hudson. He's from Northern Virginia. He's a PhD candidate in American government. What'd you think?
I love the speech. I thought what the president did with this speech was he represented a sea change in attitudes about the role of federal government. After decades of being told government is the problem, the era of big government is over, we have a president that says, hey, there's a role the government plays in fixing our problems. And he said government doesn't supplant private enterprise, it catalyzes it. It'll get the lines of credit flowing again. There's a role for government to play. I think too often... reducing our dependency on government is really just code for deregulation and looking the other way. And that's one of the things that got us into this problem. So it's refreshing to hear a president say there's a role for regulation, there's a role for the government to play.
That's Gabe Hudson. He's from Northern Virginia. And we're going to move over now and talk to Danielle Olson. Danielle, you said that you wanted the president to say something that was inspiring.
Yes, and I think overall he did. I mean, he, in terms of laying out the long-term goals for America, I think he did very well in stressing that energy, healthcare, and education are three areas that we need to be innovative in. I felt inspired, especially with energy, saying that once again America needs to lead. All of that was great. I guess on a negative note, the one thing I wish he had discussed a little bit more again was the budget deficit. He touched briefly on Iraq, but I didn't get a sense of where exactly those cuts were going to come from, especially if we're moving troops into Afghanistan. But overall, I felt inspired about education. I believe that everyone should have equal access, and I think that the average American probably left that speech feeling encouraged and inspired.
Now, we're going to talk now to G.P. Manson. He's from Arlington, Virginia. He's a second-year master's student. When we talked to you earlier in the program, you said that you had reluctantly voted for Barack Obama and that the sort of school was still out. You hadn't yet decided whether it was going to work or whether you made the right decision. What do you think?
I thought it was a very fine speech, and I think his presidency, young as it is evolving well. He seems to be a quick study. The jury is out, however, on the biggest policy decision he has to make, which, of course, is what to do about the economy. And if big government spending, as the president seems to believe, is the answer to the economic problems, then at a minimum, I would hope that the new program would come with increased regulation.
So there you have three views of what we heard from students at George Mason University. We heard from George, Danielle, and Gabe, who are all, I believe, graduate students. Isn't that right?
Okay,
graduate
Linda, students thank you here. So much. NPR's Linda Wertheimer at George Mason University with students there. And joining me now here in the studio is NPR's Julie Rovner, who covers healthcare policy for us. Julie, there was a big chunk of the speech devoted to healthcare, and the president put some urgency behind his plan to overhaul the nation's healthcare system. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
I suffer no illusions that this will be an easy process. Once again, it will be hard. But I also know that nearly a century after Teddy Roosevelt first called for reform, the cost of our health care has weighed down our economy and our conscience long enough. So let there be no doubt, health care reform cannot wait, it must not wait, and it will not wait another year.
Julie Rovner, how steep a climb might that be?
Well, very steep, as we've all seen over the past 50 years. There have been five major efforts to overhaul the nation's healthcare system, all of them unsuccessful. The most recent, of course, when President Bill Clinton tried to do it in his first term and failed rather dramatically. So it will not be easy, as President Obama said. And as you could see, I think those who watched the speech from the bipartisan or partisan reaction he got, there was bipartisan applause when he said, let's do healthcare, and then he immediately went to, you know, and we've already done the children's health insurance bill, and only the Democrats stood up, because that was kind of a partisan action, and the health provisions in the stimulus bill were also kind of partisan. So we've already got this partisan thing going as we move into health care.
And do we know yet what shape an Obama health care reform plan will take?
We really don't. I think we're going to see some more details on Thursday when this budget document comes out. We know that during the campaign, he had more of a middle ground than most of the other Democrats who ran for president. He did not pledge to have an individual mandate that would require everyone to have insurance, and therefore he would not have actual universal coverage. Now, that's something that all the Democrats in Congress are very bent upon, so that may be something where there might be some play. Certainly there's a lot of talk about cost containment, and I think that's going to be the big point of tension here as we move forward, how much it's going to cost to cover everyone compared how much really it's going to be able to be squeezed out of the system in terms of holding down health care costs.
Yeah, and of course another unknown is who will be leading the charge. The original nominee to be head of HHS, Health and Human Services, Tom Daschle, of course, had to recuse, had to step back. Who is next in line, likely, to take over as Secretary of Health and Human Services?
Well, the name that we were all hearing last week is Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who originally didn't want a cabinet post back in November, December, because there was a budget standoff going on in her home state. That's been resolved. Of course, we were hoping to hear something this week, possibly tomorrow, but I just had a look at the president's schedule, and I guess we're getting a commerce secretary finally tomorrow, but no word on an HHS secretary yet, so we're still waiting. President announced there's going to be a health care summit next week, and yet there's still no one to head up this health care effort.
Okay, NPR's Julie Rovner, who covers health care and health care reform for us. Thanks so much. And we're going now to the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who joins us from his office on Capitol Hill. Senator McConnell, welcome to the program.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
You have been quite critical of what you're calling the administration's spending spree. What was your take on the president's remarks tonight?
Well, the president's a terrific speaker. I'd give him A-plus on style, and I thought he got a very warm reception by the Republican side of the aisle over in the House chamber.
You thought that was a warm reception?
Yeah, I thought he got a very warm reception. My only disappointment really was that he seemed to give short shrift to the Social Security issue, which is an issue which he and I have discussed that I thought we had a good way forward on a bipartisan basis. That was kind of given short shrift, and I fear that they may be backing away from it. Other than that, I liked what he had to say about Iraq and Afghanistan. He's basically continuing the policies of President Bush that have gotten us, you know, through the last 7 years without additional attacks here on the homeland. I think that was an intelligent move on his part. And we'll have some differences on some issues, but on the whole, I give him good marks. And I think it was important to be optimistic and a little more uplifting than he has been in describing our economic challenges. And I think he did do that tonight.
And Senator McConnell, obviously the call from Barack Obama to find common ground, even though he said that won't be easy on some of these issues. Do you think there's a reasonable chance of that, looking at the results from the vote on the stimulus bill, which got virtually no Republican support?
Yeah, well, he's not going to find common ground on, you know, that kind of piling on of debt. That's not the issue upon which he may find common ground. But to the extent that he wants to do something about our long-term indebtedness, our what we call our entitlement problems, and in particular, if he's willing to step up to the plate on Social Security, I think he'll find a large number of Republicans willing to work with him on that.
Well, I'm curious for your take also on the public opinion polls that have been coming out. One from the New York Times said that 74% of Americans think that the president is trying to work with Republicans in Congress. Very few, just 31%, think Republicans in Congress are trying to work with Barack Obama. Do you think that can backfire for your party?
Well, I think that those views are based upon the reaction to the stimulus package. Most Republicans, myself included, did not think it was a good idea to spend in excess of $1 trillion in ways that were recommended. So there were different sent to Washington.
And I'm afraid we just lost our connection with the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, who is joining us from Capitol Hill. And we're going to turn now to wrap up the hour with our political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard. Matt, final thoughts based on what you've been hearing from the conversations just now.
Well, I was just thinking about all that we've been through in the first month of the Obama presidency. We've had S-CHIP. We've had the stimulus package. We've had announcements of closing Guantanamo. We've had announcements of new troop deployments to Afghanistan. We've had the lifting of the Mexico City ban on abortion funding. We've had the Lilly Ledbetter Pay Equity Act. We've had executive orders beneficial to labor unions. If that's he's accomplished that in 1 month, that's a whole lot. It can only leads me with a conclusion that by the end of his presidency, we're all going to be exhausted.
I'm getting tired just listening.
Yeah,
we're
doing so. We're doing so much so quickly, and who knows what we're going to end up with.
E.J. Dionne, I'm curious your thoughts there on Senator Mitch McConnell, who seemed to think that the president got a pretty warm reception from Republicans tonight.
Well, he got warm reception until they started giving him the catcalls, and you know, and they just don't like raising those taxes on wealthy people. On Matt's point about exhaustion, I was in the White House today, and I ran into someone, and I said I was writing a piece on the first year of the Obama administration, because that's what it felt like.
In the first, 30-some days.
In the first 30-some days. Just a couple of quick things. One is there were a lot of interesting things hidden in this speech. On the health care front, I think they're actually going to have, from what I understand, a fairly big down payment on universal health care. And what will be left, they're going to leave to negotiation. They're not going to put down a big plan of their own because they don't want to make what they see as a mistake of the Clinton administration. They're going to leave a considerable amount of running room for the Congress. Just tucked away in the speech today, restraint in the defense budget. This is really going to be something to watch. I think they really will hold down the defense budget. That could be quite controversial. And on Obama himself, what was really striking about Governor Jindal's speech is that he kept attacking Democratic leaders in Congress. He really didn't want to distance himself too much from Barack Obama. And I think that says a lot about his standing right now.
Matt Connelly, any one phrase, any one thought that jumps out at you from the speech, something you might remember?
Well, the Obama speech is responsibility. With the Jindal speech, the Republican mantra is earmarks. And if I had just one wish in the world to be fulfilled, it would be to get the Republicans off of earmarks. They're such a trivial part of the federal budget. If Republicans are going to get back into power, they need to focus on much bigger things.
EJ? Favorite phrase?
Health care reform cannot wait. It must not wait, and it will not wait another year. And his promise of recovery, which I think we all hope he's right about.
Mara Liasson, let me bring you in here for just one last thought. Any phrase or note from this speech from President Obama tonight that sticks with you that you think really is the signature of his address tonight?
I think it's the theme of responsibility. I think that's what he stressed over and over again. I do think, you know, I agree with Matt. Matt said earlier that he was kind of setting up this straw man of people who don't want the government to do anything at all. I think that the argument over the proper role of government has gotten a little caricatured. You know, Obama says the Republicans say government has no role. Bobby Jindal said the Democrats want to make people dependent on the federal government, which also isn't true. But I do think there you have the kind of two poles of the debate, and it's going to go on through every single one of these issues.
Okay, Mara, thanks so much. And also thanks to Matt Continetti and E.J. Dionne. To recap, President Barack Obama delivered his first address to a joint session of Congress tonight, a speech that largely focused on the economy. He opened this way.
The impact of this recession is real, and it is everywhere. But while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
And President Obama explained some of his recent steps.
I know how unpopular it is to be seen as helping banks right now, especially when everyone is suffering in part from their bad decisions. I promise you, I get it. But I also know that in a time of crisis, we cannot afford to govern out of anger or yield to the politics of the moment.
That's President Obama. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal gave the Republican response, criticizing the economic stimulus package and Democrats in Congress.
Instead of trusting us to make decisions with our own money, they passed the largest government spending bill in history, with a price tag of more than $1 trillion with interest. While some of the projects in the bill make sense, their legislation is larded with wasteful spending.
It's Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal who spoke for the Republicans tonight. I'm Melissa Block. You've been listening to live special coverage of President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress and the Republican response from NPR News.